Taking the affirmative position on tonight's question is Dr. Gannon Murphy. Dr. Murphy is author of three books, including Reasons for the Christian Hope, published by Mentor Books in 2009, and is general editor of American Theological Inquiry, a biannual journal of theology, culture, and history. He holds an MA in theology from Bethel Theological Seminary and a PhD in philosophical theology from the University of Wales at Lancaster. Taking the negative position is August Berkshire. August has been an atheist activist since 1984. He is the president of Minnesota Atheists, a past vice president of Atheist Alliance International, and on the Speakers Bureau for the Secular Student Alliance. He has served on the boards of directors of several local and national atheist and humanist organizations. He has written a number of pamphlets, all of which are available on the table by the main entrance to the room. His website is augustberkshire.com. He is the owner of the Atheist License Plate for the state of Minnesota, and lest anybody question, he is also proud to be listed in the reference book, Who's Who in Hell. For the second half of tonight's program, members of the audience will be able to ask questions of the debaters.
I get to say nothing right
now. Yeah. Just like God.
How do I follow up with that one? For the remainder of the program, members of the audience will be able to ask questions of the debaters. People who wish to ask a question of Dan and Murphy should line up at the microphone on the floor on my left. Those who wish to ask a question of August Berkshire, please line up on the microphone on my right.
August, you're not gonna go to that mic there and ask me. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I've asked lots of questions. I haven't got any answers.
I realize that many members of the audience have well-informed, extensive beliefs that conflict with one, perhaps both, of the debaters. However, in order to give as many people as possible a chance to ask questions, I must and will insist that questions be no longer than 1 minute in length. Please respect this. The first question will be for August Berkshire.
Good evening. 39 years ago in this university, Dr. Phil Sparks, my biology professor, gave a last lecture as part of a series, and he referred to mathematics, and he said it is a mathematical certainty that there can be a dimension outside of our dimension that can intersect and interact with our dimension without our being aware of it, unless the being in that dimension would so desire. So I would suggest that as a refutation of hard atheism. And as far as giving a little more evidence to believe, please anyone Google Wesley Ministry Network. A very current scientist, Dr. Francis Collins, has a series called Religion and Science, Pathways to Truth. There's a free online introductory video there. Thank you.
Okay, well, I didn't hear a question, but I'll make some comments. You talked about other dimensions. Well, yeah, I mean, physicists talk about other dimensions all the time, but they're physical dimensions. They're natural dimensions. They're not supernatural dimensions. Maybe there's a supernatural dimension and we're not aware of it. Could be. But the claim is made that this supernatural realm is somehow intersecting with the natural world. And it's that intersection, that claim of intersection that I look at. And I don't find anything supernatural behind these claims.
Hank, am I able to briefly respond to that?
Yeah. All right. Yes, go ahead.
Is this on?
Yes.
Hello.
I agree with August on this particular point, that this is actually, you know, this is an interesting field of inquiry, and new articles keep on coming out about it, and I recently read an article by an Oxford physicist, a gal who has done her life's work in the idea of there being as many as, I can't remember what it is, 11 or 12 dimensions, maybe there's some physicist in here, and I found the article fascinating. Now, it may be impossible through scientific means to ultimately locate and identify these dimensions. Maybe they can only be inferred mathematically or whatever. So I'm open to that whole idea, just as August is, but I am not open to that idea as a retreat so that there's still a placeholder for God. Here's what I want to underscore that I maybe should have done earlier. It is not... I don't see God. I don't find God in the things that haven't been explained. I see and find and know God in the things that I do understand, in the things I do see, in the things I do enjoy, in the experiences I do have. I'm not looking for some diminishing frontier where I can still say, oh, well, God must be up in there somewhere. In him we live and move and have our being, wrote the Apostle Paul. That is why I see God in the things I do know, not in the things I don't know.
Thank you. And your question?
My question is that this, and either one is free to respond. Fine, before I do, I have a brief information. In the late 90s and early 2000s, two doctors, one a marine biologist and archaeologist by the name of Pontian, asked two questions. One, did the biblical Exodus occur? Number two, if it did occur, was it natural by vast nature, or was there a God to take action for it? Well, in the Gulf of Aqaba, on a narrow strip of silt, was found coral shaped in chariot wheels and the bars that go between them. And as it is scientifically known, the only way coral can grow in such a weird manner is if it attached to such a host that was designed in such a manner. Now, my question is, how can such chariots, or how could such coral in such a formation, in a wheel which was made in a couple centuries in ancient Egypt dynasty, be found at the bottom of a silt or such a walkway, when it is scientifically impossible for such vehicles to be there in the first place?
I have absolutely no idea.
Well, what I'm asking is, how can something that's meant to be on land be at the bottom of the ocean when it was not able to get there in the first place?
I'm not sure.
Physical by itself.
Can someone tase him?
Yeah. So you have a chariot on the barge, and the chariot falls over, and you get a chariot wheel at the bottom of the river.
Well, are you arguing that this is evidence for a global flood, or is it?
No, what I'm asking. No, what I'm asking is
prior to.
What I'm asking is
prior to the Exodus.
What I'm asking is what these. How did the scientist find something that was meant to be on land in the middle of a gulf, strictly upon a specific space of land, when it isn't meant to be there in the first place?
It sounds like there's a question for me, and I answered it.
I'm going to interject here and suggest we ask another questioner to step up to the microphone. Thank you.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, hopefully I won't be tased after I finish asking my question.
Excuse me. Tase me, bro.
I would ask you to step back just a little bit from your microphone.
Is that okay?
There's a mumbling taking place when you stand too close. Go ahead.
Yeah. My question is in reference to, it was mentioned before as the law of human nature. You were mentioning acting ethically right and wrong. If there is no God, if man is just the result of random chance, and then man has eventually become what it is today, where did that law of nature come from? You talk about it as the idea of right and wrong. So the idea that telling a lie would be wrong, that telling the truth is right. Would there ever have been a man, whoever created that? Think back to like a society where somebody determines, okay, we're going to establish this, that telling the truth is going to be the right thing to do, or stabbing my friends in the back or doing something that hurts them, that's going to be the wrong thing to do. Where would that come from? Where would you attribute that if there is no God? Yeah. That there is no law of human nature that's placed upon a man by God?
Human nature comes from evolution. and we evolved as a social species. So we have an instinct for selfishness, but we also have an instinct for cooperation, because cooperation would have benefited our tribe, which in turn would have benefited us. So evolution would have favored both behaviors, selfishness and cooperation. Let me read you a list of examples of cooperation and justice and compassion that we find in other animals. And I think you have to ask yourself, is God implanting a moral instinct in animals too, or doesn't evolution really explain this better? A group of elephants rescued a group of caged antelopes by undoing the latches on the gate. A rat in a cage refused to push a lever for food when it saw that another rat received an electric shock as a result. A female monkey couldn't figure out how to put a token in a slot to get food, and she was helped by a male monkey who put the token in the slot for her and then allowed her to eat the food. A female bat helped another female bat who was trying to give birth by showing her the proper way to hang. A cat led her elderly deaf and blind dog friend away from obstacles and toward food. A group of chimpanzees in a zoo punished a chimp who arrived late for dinner because the rules were that no one eats until everyone is present. These are just a few examples of cooperation, empathy, and a sense of justice that we find in the non-human animal world. And as I said, I gave the example of the bacteria. You have a petri dish full of bacteria that's exposed to antibiotics. A small number of resistant bacteria sacrifice some of their own growth to help out their less resistant fellow bacteria. So we find cooperation in nature. There were evolutionary benefits for it being preserved.
And a detail that those of us involved in the organization did not deal with was the ability to respond at this point to the answer being given on the other side. And because of the length of the number of people lined up to ask questions, I'm going to ask on both sides here that there not be a response to the
Well, agreed. We can try to keep it brief, though, if you want to say something.
We have 10 people.
I am admittedly not the paragon of brevity.
All right.
I do think that there is... I don't think, as the famous atheist J.L. Mackey has conceded, if we are going to grant the existence of an objective morality, a trans-historical, trans-cultural morality, J.L. Mackey, himself an avowed atheist, said that if we affirm an objective morality of that sort, it makes the case for God more likely. That's all I'll say.
All right. And your question?
Yes. Right away, at the first of your speech, I got right away, you says, gods, you said, with an S. There's only one God. You do not read the Bible at all. You do not know the Bible.
Oh, excuse me. I had asked that people on this side be directing their questions to Gannon.
Oh, all right. Sorry.
All right. Go ahead.
And you know, I don't know where you're getting this from. I know I'm older than you, and God has proven in my life that He exists.
Well, the Bible talks about other gods. I'm just following the Bible.
You're following the Bible?
Yeah, the Bible talks about other gods.
There you go again. Other gods. You have said it in your speech. Okay. Yes, you did. You use more than one God. Yeah. There's only one.
Yeah. Okay, well, that sounds like a speech. Another question for Gannon, maybe?
I'm losing track of things here real quick.
Well, wait a second. All right, I tell you what. I forgive me. I don't mean to be rude, but I get to make a response because that one was sure. Like all messed up, right?
All right.
So protocol was broken. Other gods, I took a little jab at August in my opening remark that I said this reference to gods, as the gentleman put it, I think is an attempt at a rhetorical flourish and a little effect. But I know Dawkins is all the rage. Richard Dawkins is all the rage today for the atheists. The discipleship of Dawkins is incredible to me. But there, Christians, that Dawkins has pointed out, I'll agree with him on this, and August will probably agree, that Christians are atheists too when it comes to Odin, the divine god of this fine theater, or Wotan, or Osiris, or Thor, or Zeus. I am an Azusist. Proud Azusist. That's what I'm going to get in my license plate. That's Azusist. Atheists like Christians reject this pantheon of gods. Atheists say that they just go one step further in rejecting one god less. Well, folks, this is like saying that the difference between marriage and celibacy is one relationship less. It doesn't make sense, and it's not a solid argument. It muddles the debate.
And
okay, I'm sorry.
Trying to bring some balance back here, I will go over here to have the question addressed to Gannon Murphy.
My question is kind of pertaining to the whole gap of the gods thing, and you said that, like, there's what God there's everything in nature, and then everything else is explained by God. And if you kind of put that on a scale, on time, and like way back 10,000 years ago, it was like way over here where like everything was explained with gods, and then like up here would be where everything is explained with science. We're somewhere along that scale, and it's been moving pretty steadily since then, and it moves within our lifetime. Are you static on there, or when new scientific discoveries are made, do you accept them as being like, oh, I guess that's not God, that is some scientific thing?
Right. It's quite to the contrary. I considered studying physics. I'll make an admission. It was partly financial too, but physics fascinates me. I didn't think I had the mathematical chops to think better conceptually. So I am quite an avid follower of scientific discoveries. And I celebrate when new scientific discoveries are made. I can't even comprehend what it would mean for me as a theist to see an advance in science and to recoil and say, "Ooh, God just got a little less for me."
If you are following along on that scale, then sorry, should
one
I
question,
not?
One question, please.
Yeah. See, yeah,
it, the, I think make that, sense that it would keep going.
But that's exactly what I'm trying to explain. Is that the image that's painted in this God of the gaps argument is of here? Say we have a triangle and we're dealing, or a balloon. We have a balloon and it's filled with air, mystery. And as science progresses, it's getting filled up with water, and God is getting relegated into the air. And as the balloon continues to fill up with water, you know, God is relegated to the air. To, you know, at some point the balloon will fill with water and there'll be absolutely no need for God at all. That's why I tried to point out that first, I don't see God in the things that we don't know. I see God in the things we do. Secondly, there's a confusion here between agency and mechanism. I have three children, and if my kids say to me, "Daddy, why are the leaves green?" I don't say, "Well, God did it." Or say, "Well, because of sunlight, chlorophyll, and the process of photosynthesis." It's both. There's a difference between agency and mechanism. Much of this is cleared up in a study of Aristotle and how Aristotle understood causation, that you have agency behind cause. It's not, you have an efficient cause, you have a material or instrumental cause of something. This is what science studies. But you also have a telos, an agency behind the thing. Think of it in terms of a statue. You have the physical material, and you have the tools, the instruments to make it, but you have the agency of the artist's mind. I think it was Michelangelo, no, it was Rodin, who said that when he saw a block of granite, his job was to let the face out. And that's what I'm saying, that's the difference between agency and mechanism. This God of the Gaps argument reduces everything to mechanism.
Well, you talk about agency and mechanism, but the agent being God, again, we don't know what a God is. And mechanism, we don't know how a God operates. So to say God is any part of this equation adds nothing to it.
Question from the...
Well, I'll grant you also that Rodin was kind of a meanie.
Question?
What about... Hello? Okay. Hi, I'm glad both of you are here. I never thought this would ever happen in UW-La Crosse. I have like a question for both of y'all. Can I do that right here? Or I got to change sides?
Go to the back of that line.
Start your question there, and then...
She gets a tase-free double question. I vote.
Okay, for both of you, do you believe that the Bible was used as a tool, and do you believe that religion is used widespread for mind control or to help guide the world?
Is religion used as a tool? Yeah, certainly it's used as a tool. It can be used to inspire people to good behavior or to inspire them to bad behavior. It's all there. The Bible's kind of like a Rorschach test. And there's some nasty things in it. You're supposed to kill disobedient sons, gay people, people who work on the Sabbath, people who believe in another God. Or there's some good things about being kind to one another. And the fact is, most Christians pick and choose. They reject the nasty stuff and they focus on the good stuff. Well, how can they identify which parts of the Bible are good and which parts are bad? It's because they're bringing an outside-the-Bible morality to bear on the Bible. They can't be using the Bible itself because God is proclaiming both good and bad things, both terrible actions and good actions. So it has to be their own human sense of goodness and ethics that they're bringing to bear on the supposedly God-authored Bible.
It's a good question, and the first thing that comes to mind, my favorite philosopher, the French philosopher Blaise Pascal, once said, there is no evil so pernicious as that done in the name of religion. Absolutely, there are religions and cults and sects out there that engage in a form of mind control and engage in a kind of an authoritarian grip over the minds of its adherents. And it's a great danger to our world. I'll leave it at that, sure.
And as I understand, who's in charge here anyway?
As I understand, the next question would be here directed to Gannon Murphy.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that you have reaffirmed my faith in Zoroaster. You've made a great argument for him. In fact, the only positive argument I heard was sort of a first cause in the general argument for a God of some kind that began the universe at some point. I'm sure many Christians here would be just ecstatic, and atheists too would be ecstatic if you would make an argument for the Christian God in particular, the Judeo-Christian Abrahamic God of the Bible. And I don't think we've heard anything to support the attributes that many of us here probably ascribe to that God. So would you care to make such an argument?
Okay. Two things. One, I think you missed a lot of what I said. Two, as a Christian, I'm in a bit of a dilemma when I agree to do a debate like this. Because the title of this debate is, Does God Exist? That is what I came to defend, is that God exists. I did not come to argue for, but generally I'm arguing that a God exists in the sense of monotheism, as God is commonly understood. I did not come here to, though I will, to defend the veracity of the Christian faith in particular. Or to defend, this isn't a debate about the resurrection or the validity of the Bible. I came here under the terms of the debate, which was a debate over the existence of God, and that's what I defended. Now, yes, I would make a positive case for why, among the plurality of religions, that I think that Christianity is the true religion, It's far too much to go into right now, but I have no idea what your comment about Zoroaster is.
It was in response. You made a first cause argument that did not close in on any particular
I didn't God. At any time make a first cause argument. So I don't follow. I live in a post-Newtonian world. Okay, I understand something about modern science. And I didn't make any kind of a rigid first cause argument. You're hearing an argument that you've read somewhere or heard somebody else say. It's nothing that I said. Now I've lost my track of what I was going to say in a second.
No, but you're right. The terms of the debate were generic God, and I certainly don't blame you for not defending a particular God. It was a generic God. I myself tried to critique the idea of a generic God. A couple times I said, but if you believe in the Christian God, then certain things follow. But I, too, was trying to stick mostly to a critique of a generic God.
Thank you. And a question for August.
Using the laws of thermodynamics, where did the universe come from? The first law, being matter, energy at rest, and energy, cannot be created or destroyed. The second law, saying that everything is going from more usable energy to less usable energy. Entropy, things were out. One law says the universe cannot create itself. The other says it had to have a beginning, where all energy was usable. And not long ago, since we have not suffered a heat death, the state of no usable energy, where did the universe come from?
Well, the first law of thermodynamics, that what matter and energy can neither be created nor destroyed, would seem to argue against a God. Wouldn't it? In entropy, the universe has kind of been running down, you know, since the Big Bang. There are theories as to where the universe came from. It's speculation. Can you clarify your question a little more? I have a feeling I'm not answering it to your satisfaction.
My point being that an outside of natural forces must be involved.
Oh, I don't see that as a necessity at all. So,
Gannon,
I have no response to that.
Question of Gannon.
Okay, bear with me. I have a bad taste of stage right here, but so I have a question about your comment that religion and science are complementary. About what that means? Does that mean that, for instance, that they haven't made any statements about the same thing? Or that science and religion could never make claims that contradict each other. Specifically, for instance, virgin birth, or the talking snake, or the power of prayer that a lot of religious people would like to believe in.
Right. that's the natural and proper thing to bring up in anybody who makes a statement that there's no conflict between science and Christianity.
Happy?
Okay. Christianity and religion. Yes, of course. There have been times when there have been claims that are competing. Most of the time, I think that on those claims that both sides are overstepping their bounds. For example, you have Stephen... it's amazing to me how some scientists will wax on about religion and make all these religious claims that are huge leaps from the actual evidence that they've had. Stephen Hawking, in his famous book, A Brief History of Time, you know, made the statement that it could be such and such something before the Big Bang, but it could also be the inflationary model, the oscillating universe model, or something like that. In which case, no need for a created God. Well, Stephen Jay Gould, the biologist, tried to foster, and I'm not totally sympathetic with it, that is 100%, but I'm about 95% of the way there. He advanced what he called NOMA, non-overlapping magisteria. And this basically means that the scientific toolkit is designed to answer a certain set of questions. Science measures how far, how fast, how wide, mechanism. Philosophy and theology seek to answer a different set of questions that the tools of science can never answer. The tools of science cannot tell you whether or not you should make that commitment and marry your girlfriend.
That is to say that virgin births and things like this are not a question of religion, then.
Well, this whole thing, see, this again goes back to philosophy. If one out of hand dismisses the possibility of miracles, as David Hume famously did, then there's absolutely no way that there's going to be a way to acknowledge the possibility of a virgin birth. Plus, one of the difficulties with the virgin birth and also with the existence of the universe is that in both cases what we have are sui generis events. These are singular events. We don't have them repeated, so we can't keep on going back and science needs that. It needs repeatable conditions. So if one a priori rules out the possibility of miracles, then of course a virgin birth isn't going to be possible. I believe in the virgin birth. I believe it occurred. I believe it's a miracle. I don't believe it violates any law of logic. I believe that it's a case of God superintending into the world by his power. The mechanism, I have no idea. When I was a bit younger and in the seminary, I thought I knew the answer to all those kinds of questions, but I'm 38, a little older now, and I realize when I should just say, I don't know. I hope that...
Religion and science are only complementary, or at least not in conflict, if religion either makes claims that can't be examined, or if it makes claims that can be examined, that the results of that examination are not in conflict with what science says. Wherever there's been a conflict between science and religion that we can't examine, it's always science that's won. You know, God says that we're the center of the universe, we're the most important creatures of a God, so Earth is the center and it's flat. That was a religious revelation from God. Well, you know, science
that's
won that.
That's patently false, August,
yeah.
And you know
but,
better.
No, but that's what the Bible says. The Bible is a flat earth.
August.
It's a flat earth. You've got the dome above the heavens, the gates, the flood waters coming in.
August.
it's the flat earth, the columns, God in his throne above the firmament.
August, I am trying to quit Advil. Okay.
Well, you can take up atheism.
Do you have any idea? August, that is the most profoundly poor piece of biblical exegesis I think I have ever heard.
Well, I'll refer you to the websites which, you know, that show all the quotes from the Bible.
Websites with these litanies of contradictions,
yeah.
And they are so manifestly absurd,
yeah.
It makes one want to lie down in a wet alleyway and vomit himself.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that everything makes you feel that way.
Just to the evening here.
Anyway, we'll continue to the next question.
Yes. I guess you know where to find me after.
And the next question is... in the excitement, I've lost who's the next question.
There we are. All right.
It's private. Yeah.
Dr. Berkshire, you have several times demanded that someone show you exactly what a God is made of and how a God does what he does. I would ask, why do you need to know? Because a God, by definition, must have something about it that we as creations, or at least less powerful and less knowledgeable than this God, cannot understand. If we understood everything about God, he would not be God.
Well, you asked why I need to know what a God is and how a God operates. Why do I need to know? I need to know so I know what we're talking about. I don't need to know everything about a God, but the fact is I don't know anything about a God.
Oh, we are back to responding.
Yourself out of the gutter.
Oh, I missed that.
Or alleyway.
What is
whatever.
That? You challenged me to a cage match?
I would lose, I think.
I think that you do, August. This is a terrible, terrible route to go because this is telling somebody what they actually think, which is really just bad policy. But I believe that we all have something that is known among theologians as a sensus divinitatis. It's an innate sense of the divine. We have some concept of God. If you couldn't have any concept of God at all, you wouldn't even have any ammunition to argue against the concept of God. And you've iterated a number of things that are classical attributes of God: omniscience, omnipotence, eternality, and so forth. Now, one must understand that in classical Christian theism, there has always been maintained a doctrine of the incomprehensibility of God. Finitum non capax infinitum. The finite cannot contain, capax, the finite cannot contain the infinite. We're finite. God is infinite. That means we cannot have anything like a full-orbed comprehension of God. However, if this were taken to too far an extreme, Christian theology understands, classical Christian theology understands, it would lead to a pious agnosticism. So this doctrine of incomprehensibility is tempered with finitum passe apprehensio infinitum. The finite is able to apprehend something of the infinite. If we couldn't, we couldn't know anything at all about God. We know something about God through three ways: creation, conscience, and Christ. I concentrated mainly tonight on the first two for the purposes of the debate, but I'll leave it at that.
Well, some of us don't have an innate sense of the divine. I certainly don't. And when I talk about various characteristics of gods, these are claims that I get from religious people, not from any innate sense I have of a god.
And a question from the left.
Dr. Murphy, you mentioned briefly that in order for one to have a reasonable basis for aesthetic value, that is to believe in beauty, you need to have a position of theism. Would you make a brief logical argument as to why that is, at the risk of losing part of our audience?
Wait, are you Zoroastrian?
No, I'm his twin.
I have a philosophical position about this, a theistic philosophical position about this, that you must understand from the outset that not all theologians agree with. Because I would very much argue with most theists that God is what provides a plumb line or a mooring for the existence of objective morality, an objective morality that everybody lives by and is inviolate. And I'm not sure if this is quite answering your question, but I believe also in my own researches and my own understanding, I've tried to learn more about art and various forms of art and whatnot, that God is described in Scripture as terrifyingly beautiful, as a delightful terror, that so much so that the Old Testament and the New ratifies it, taught that God is so awesome to behold that to see God was to die. To see God with nakedly is to die. And it's not because God is this big ghoul, but it's because it's like what looking at the sun would do to your eyes. It would burn them.
So the very thing that keeps us alive can also kill us. It's very interesting, sorry for the sidebar, but it's very interesting that the same sun that brings up the plants is also and gives them life is the same one that kills them and causes them to decay when that life goes out of them. I believe in God, that there actually is an objective standard for beauty. And this rails against modern conventional thinking, because people say, well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. That's true normatively. But what I'm saying is that the more we seek God, the more we'll understand about beauty. And we'll understand that things that we formerly thought beautiful aren't so beautiful. And I know I'm rambling, but I'll just give one last example. I always liked classical music a little bit, but I was mostly like younger. I was into The Doors and, you know, I don't know, Fouras into Black Sabbath, stuff like that. But I was into, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and I don't even know if you guys, boy, now I'm feeling old. Have you guys ever seen the movie Blade Runner? How many hands on Blade Runner? Okay, good, because love that movie. Anyway, it was an age check, because that movie came out in the 80s. Anyway, I didn't appreciate Chopin very much. I just didn't. And then I began reading about Chopin and began reading about the music. And the same thing happened with Beethoven. The same thing happened with Brahms, in fact, and the same thing happened with, Rachmaninoff. And I began reading about the music and the impulses behind the music, and I started listening to the music with that background information in mind. And what I once didn't find beautiful, I began to find beautiful. So I think we can grow in our understanding of beauty. Christianity teaches that all truth meets at the top. All that is true meets at the top in God. And that includes the objectivity of beauty. I'll have to leave it at that. Right.
No, thank you. That's very articulate.
Yeah, these are theological claims for which there's no evidence. Speaking of music and movies, how many of you have seen Clockwork Orange? Okay. I think one's standards can be altered by one's environment.
And a question for August.
I'd like to preface my question by saying that I am a philosophy major. And as a symptom of that, I completely disagreed with most of what I heard both of you say.
You are a philosophy major.
You continue to say that God, or to give you the benefit of the doubt, gods, has not been defined. But you continue to refer to God or gods as supernatural. Is this not a criteria itself that we might adhere to a definition? And don't your arguments against God's definition contradict your assertion that God has not been defined by theists? So basically, I'd like you to address the fact that in addition to twice misusing the term begging the question, you might address the fact that your argument seems to beg the question in the way that Aristotle originally intended the term to mean.
Well, what does supernatural mean? It just means not natural. So again, I said, we know what God isn't, but we don't know what God is. Supernatural just says what it isn't.
Right, but by giving him an isn't, you are defining him, and your entire argument hinges on the fact that he can't be defined. He or she or it.
If something's not red, it could be blue, it could be brown, you know, we don't know. So I'm just saying one thing it isn't, but I'm not still not understanding what a God is composed of. It's not composed of atoms. Okay, I know that. What is it composed of?
Okay. I'm going to hit you with something.
I think we should gang up on him.
This is terrible to do because I have to make this so quick. I'm doing this because you're a philosophy major and because it's directly related to this, and it's because we can make inferences via philosophy and using the canons of reason to arrive at certain conclusions about God. Okay, I can't explain to those of you who don't know what syllogistic logic is and syllogistic reasoning is. I can't take the time to explain it. Track with me. There are two possible kinds of entities, only two.
You come up with a third, tell me after, and I'll completely revise everything. Two possible kinds of entities, dependent or contingent entities, that is, entities that derive their existence from another entity, or independent, or that is, necessary entities, entities that do not derive their existence from another. Premise two, dependent entities, dependent, contingent entities undeniably exist. Premise three, there are two possible explanations for dependent entities, of which we all are, as well as a rock, a plant, whatever. One, they arise from another dependent entity. Two, they arise from an independent entity. Premise four, if every entity arose from other dependent entities, an infinite regress of dependent entities is implied. Premise five, an infinite regress or space-time index of dependent agencies is impossible because, one, it is no more able to cause itself than a single dependent entity. Two, time finds its terminus in the present, precluding the infinity needed for an infinite collection of space-time past. Conclusion, therefore, an independent, that is, necessary being, must exist. And by its very nature, because it is this necessary being, it is therefore eternal, atemporal, non-corporeal, and omnipotent. And this necessary being we naturally call God.
Well, this sounds like a fancy way of the first cause argument.
It has nothing to do with the first cause argument.
What about the idea that matter and energy could have always existed? I mean, you can't dispute that that's possible in some form, that matter and energy always existed in some form. We don't know that it couldn't have.
Right. Poor folks. I'll just...
All right. Okay. My question comes from an argument by Christopher Hitchens, and that being...
Sorry.
That being, what took your God so long? What I mean by that is, we know the human species has been around for at least 100,000 years. So what was heaven doing for 98,000 years before God, in the form of Christ, chose to reveal himself in primitive, illiterate Palestine? Why in Palestine?
Primitive, illiterate Palestine.
Why not China, where people can read? And how is this?
Sir, that is what C.S. Lewis would call a fine piece of chronological snobbery, my friend.
Tell it to Christopher Hitchens.
Well, you seem to be agreeing with him. You know, I'm assuming you're recapitulating his argument because you think it has some force.
I believe it does.
That's why I responded to you in the manner in which I did, sir.
Yes.
I'm not that bad a psychologist. May not be a trained one, but what was God doing before the creation of humans? And your comment about the...
No, I didn't say the creation of humans. I said whatever. Humans had already been around for
totally
at least 100,000 years.
Unhelpful. Say again?
I said that not before the creation of humans. I said humans had been around for at least 100,000 years, 250,000 years.
Okay. So
what took God so long?
This is not a question that... This is a question without an answer. It's like this litany of questions that August brings up that, well, actually, most of us do have
an answer. How can God be compassionate?
You have asked your question, sir.
Well, what was God doing? I'm going to answer in this way, okay? Because I don't know. I have an apprehension of God, as I explained. I don't have a full comprehension of the infinite. I can't because I'm finite.
Why?
Hold on, sir. I'm answering your question, okay? Just hang on. God is revealed not only by nature and in our conscience, but also in Holy Writ. To be a God whose constituent nature involves creativity, it is a part of God's nature to create. Now, when Christian theology talks about the imago Dei, meaning the image of God in humans, we humans also have a creative impulse. We have a desire to create. Some through art, some through architecture, some through writing, etc., etc. This is part of what it means to be created in the imago Dei, is that you are sharing a communicable attribute of God, which is God's self-existent creativity. It is in God's nature to create. He doesn't create because he has to.
He doesn't create because he's forced to by some god bigger than him or whatever. He creates because it's his nature to do so. Why he chose, what God was doing in eons past, I have no idea. Any more than I have the idea of whether maybe God created totally different kinds of beings somewhere. I know the world in which we live, and I go based on what we know. But you ask me questions, you're asking me a question that is patently impossible for anybody to answer, and the reason is because you'd have to ask God.
Well, I agree that God is very inscrutable.
And I am going to suggest that because of this, the facility staff here that needs to be able to close up the hall, we are 5 minutes before 9 o'clock. I know that Gannon had offered to be around for some questions on an informal basis.
Sure. And I promise to be like, sir.
August sure. could be as well. Yeah. And so on an informal basis, those of you who may have questions, gentlemen, could you be out perhaps out in the hall
sure.
for
yeah.
a little bit?
Yeah, we're happy to be omnipresent.
Yes, we will be omnipresent. but we're going to have to do it in kind of like a sneering around kind of way.
Well, with that, I'm sure that we all are glad that we finally came to the answer, that we've all gotten the answer of whether God exists.
Thank you for coming. There is literature out in the hall for those of you who may want to stop at the tables on the way out.